Thanks for letting me come on your boat. It's been an incredible trip.
Yeah, I'm glad it worked out for you.
Yeah, me too.
I just didn't know how it would, you know, if you can't over plan these things. You just have to, you know.
Yeah. I know it felt to you like over planning, I'm sure.
Oh, no, I wasn't referring to that so much. I just meant, you know, that, you know, we ended up not going back to Christmas, which kind of seemed like, you know, a big change, but, you know, that's just how it is. We just don't know.
Yeah. Well, actually, it was really, I mean, it was a little bit of an arduous journey coming north, but I was actually really glad to stay on the boat, because I think if I'd only done that loop, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have gotten to know the crew. I wouldn't really have gotten to know, like, the personality of the boat at all.
Right.
You know, I would have just seen what the boat is like in that little tiny cluster of islands, and it's obviously got so much more of a personality beyond that.
Yeah. Well, so that's the whole thing, is the, you know, the huge distances in between the stops that you, you know, the boat has to handle. The boat is built for it. That's what it's all about.
And now this passage between Washington and Honolulu, is that the longest passage that you do?
Well, actually, between Christmas and Honolulu is a little bit longer, but it's basically the same passage.
How long is that, the Christmas to Honolulu?
It's another 150 miles, I think.
Okay.
So, and that's usually what we do, because we almost always go back to Christmas before heading north. And a lot of that decision this time, some of that was based on the fact that the winds were not strong trade winds, which they normally are. So you don't really want to start from Washington, because that's that much further west. So you got to fight your way, you know, further east. But in this case, with the reversal of the wind patterns in the, you know, in the lower first half of the trip, it didn't really matter.
Yeah, it was amazing. We had this incredible southwest, apparently usually non-existent, huh?
It's very unusual. It's El Nino, and it's the, you know, it's all tied in with El Nino.
Yeah. So I have a lot of questions about the Kwai, but I also have some questions about you.
Okay.
I mean, Ben was telling me that your ancestor is Nathaniel
Bowditch.
Yeah. So you have a little bit of a history of being on the sea.
Yeah. Well, that's, he was, you know, I'm a direct descendant, but, and also a lot of other people in my family and that side of the family were captains, you know, out of New England ports.
And so has it been consistent since the 1700s that your family has this, you know, history of being at sea?
No, I would say not, because my parents' or grandparents' generation, there was nobody who went to sea. But before that, there was. Captains.
So your great-grandfather was a captain?
Yeah.
What kind of a boat was he a captain?
Well, they were on, you know, out of the schooners that worked out of New England and went all over, and the tall ships too, the clipper ships. That's a little further back. But,
right.
Yeah.
But so your great-grandfather was schooner?
Yes.
And before that, his ancestry was on clipper ships?
There, yeah, I don't actually, I haven't followed it to know exactly, but I just know that from, you know, the stories that they were captains. I don't really, can't tell you this, who was on the ship and this and that.
Yeah,
it'd be fun to research. I'm sure it can be done, but I haven't done it.
So then when did you start sailing?
Well, I ran away to sea when I was 20 and got involved in a boat that was a floating commune. And basically, about 20 people, we got together and decided to go buy a boat. And the idea was to fix it up in 6 months and sail around the world in 2 years and then go back to college. And, well, we did it, but after 2 years, we were still fixing it up. And it took 8 years to finally sail around the world. And it was, most of the people did not survive, you know, that trip. It was, you couldn't... It wasn't an investment. You put in $1,500, and that bought you a you could be on the boat, but if you weren't on the boat, you had no say in what happened to the boat. So it wasn't really an investment. People came and, you know, did some time. A lot of people didn't like it and left. And, you know, it went through. In the end, there ended up over 50 owners of the boat.
Where was the home port?
The home port wasn't a home port, because we sailed around the world, and then, you know, we had the name on the stern was, we actually sailed around the world without ever registering the boat, which is
something
you can't do anymore. This was in the 70s.
Yeah.
You can't do that now. You know.
Yeah.
Can't come close, you know. And finally we registered it in St. Thomas because we wanted to go to the U.S. And so we figured you had to have some registry to go to the U.S.
And so where did you get on? I mean, where did you get involved? Like, where were you living when you got involved in this?
I was living in Massachusetts. And I went to Denmark to join the boat where they had just bought it. And we started from there. Yeah. At that time, you could buy boats really cheap. We bought her for, you know, 90-foot boat for $7,000.
Sailboat?
She was originally a sailboat. When we bought her, she was had no sail on her. But she was originally a three-masted sailing vessel, and we rigged her again as that.
And so is that where you got the idea to do it? It was from that boat?
Yes, because the second boat I had was commercial. We did cargo with it, and that was, that evolved from the first ship, yeah. And now Kwai is the third ship I've done.
So what was the name of the second boat?
The second boat was Edna.
Oh, okay, right. So,
which I later sold to Nancy Griffith. And Terry. Terry was an owner of hers.
Oh, okay. So where was the Edna? How did you and Terry and Nancy meet?
Well, I met Nancy when she bought Edna. This was in 87. And I met Terry through that connection. I'm not sure exactly where, but we have a group of people that know each other from that time.
And the Edna was in the Pacific?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But had you brought the Edna from...
Yeah, we bought Edna in Denmark and fixed her up in Europe, in Portugal. And then we worked a little while in the West Indies and to the East Coast. We started a lumber business that I ended up keeping, actually, after that, out of Suriname up to... the West Indies, St. John.
Really?
Yep, Cruz Bay.
So what year is, what year were you, what?
That was, I bought her in 78, and I sold her in 87, so it was in the 80s, because we didn't finish her until April, I think, of 80. And then we came over to the East Coast and started working there.
I think I heard about you from a friend of mine who was born and raised in St. John. She was telling me how there used to be a sailing cargo ship that would come. Yeah,
we worked with Glenn as Mongoose Junction architect.
Oh, yeah.
And then we worked with David Knight. He had a wood business there for a while.
Yeah, I know. I know who he is. I don't know him personally, but... Yeah. Oh, okay. And so you were bringing lumber to them.
Yeah. And to St. Thomas, and to the U.S. East Coast, and to Beckway. We had quite a few islands we stopped at.
And so did you have the Edna and Martha's Vineyard? I heard something about Martha's Vineyard.
No. We had the Edna once in Martha's Vineyard, but we had Kwai in Martha's Vineyard for a year and a half.
Okay. And I think that's when I first heard about you.
Yeah, we were living there, and I was working at Gannon and Benjamin, the boatyard there. In April, my wife was, you know, had a job with the health food company, White Wave. She was the regional manager, so we were living on Martha's Vineyard. And that's when we actually bought Kwai and ended up bringing her over there. because we had a great deal from Ralph Packer, who owns the had a dock there that he let us use.
And so where did you bring her from?
We bought her in Norway.
Okay.
And she was abandoned. She'd been burned for insurance and, you know, just was going to the scrapyard. I was looking for a boat for another guy, actually. Ralph Packer wanted to buy a boat, and I was looking for a boat for him, and we found her and realized that we could make something go with her.
Uh-huh. And so what was she in her past life?
Well, she was built as a fishing boat, as a drift net fisherman. That they set their drift net off the side of the boat, and you know, they stay out for months because they were not freezer in those days. It was salt fish. And it was, that was a big trade in Europe. That was, you know, the first salt fish of the season would always come in and be presented to the queen in Holland, you know, and it was, it was like a cod in the East Coast. You know, it was a huge business with a lot of tradition. So she was built for that in 1950, but then in the 60s she was bought and went to Norway and converted to cargo. And then her last trade, as a lot of these boats would, was the asphalt. They load them up with hot asphalt and drive to somewhere and get it out quickly to pave a road or make a parking lot or whatever they do.
And so when was the Kwai built? What year, do you
1950.
Know? 1950.
In Germany.
So it was never built to sail originally?
Yeah, she had a sailing rig, but not so much to go long distances. It was a small, short rig that was intended to keep her stable while on the fishing grounds. And so that they could, work the fish and stay headed up into the wind and hold their position, basically. I mean, you could have used the sails to get home, too, if the engine broke down. It was just a short rig, very similar to the rig that we're putting on her now.
Uh-huh. And so, I'm just skipping around a little, maybe, I don't know. But, so with the Edna, you bought the Edna with the intention, was the Edna also rigged to sail, or you said?
No, she was all the same. She was also built as a herring fishing boat, and she had a sailing rig on her, the same kind of small rig at one time. But when I bought her, there was no sailing rig on her again, but we put a rig back on her.
And that you did in Portugal?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, okay. And so how did you, so once you did that, why did you decide to sell the Edna?
It had a... just some setbacks, and really I wanted to live ashore, and I couldn't find anybody else to run the boat. My family had been on board, and they had gotten off, in Hawaii when we came out to the Pacific, and I wanted to spend more time with them and, you know, to be on shore, and I just really couldn't find anybody else who could do both the captain and the business. And so I decided to sell.
And so how did you and Nancy connect?
I don't know. I think it was word of mouth. I'm pretty sure. We didn't advertise it.
Because the Edna was still in the Atlantic and Nancy
No,
was
no, no. We're in the Pacific. We've been in the Pacific for 4 years.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, word of mouth in the sailing.
Yeah. And I sold her first to a guy who was going to make a dinner cruise boat out of her in Manila Bay. And they actually put a deposit and, you know, came to pick her up. And then the guy who runs the dinner cruise boats here, Robert Halcrow, somehow was involved. And he came to Palau, where we were doing the sale, and convinced the Filipino guy not to buy her.
To give him his deposit back?
No, we ended up with a deposit. It wasn't much, you know. But then I got the I think Nancy had already contacted me before that. And then I wrote to her and said, well, no, well, she's still for sale. And so she bought her.
So it was Nancy's idea to run cargo to the Line Islands. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
We had never worked for the Line Islands.
And I
We've
guess
been working in Micronesia and all north of the equator. Well, Line Islands are still north of the equator, but she had been, I'm not sure how she knew about the Line Islands, but I guess she had been there on her other boat. She had a boat with Terry, the Goodwin.
Yeah.
So I think they'd sailed there, and she, you know, knew about it.
Yeah.
And she worked there. I did one trip with her, the first trip, and it was very successful. And then she, just the politics, actually, really what happened to her, you know, the guy who she was working with decided to buy his own boat, and they yanked her license, so she went on to the Cook Islands and worked there for another 3 years before she lost the boat on the reef.
And at what point did you go, I should do that? I should.
Oh no, I didn't. That was not an idea, really. Except when we got the idea for Kwai going and started going with it. Remember, this took a long time. It wasn't. We were 4 years fixing her up before we came out to the Pacific. So it was organic, you know. But. Really, we chose the route because you go across the wind both ways. So from Hawaii to Rarotonga and the Cook Islands is pretty much a north-south run. And that way you can use the trade winds all the way. Because a boat wants to run across the wind. It's much better than going either upwind, of course, is slow. And going straight downwind is slow. But what's the most efficient way to use the wind is have the wind on the beam on the side. And so that was our intention, was in picking the route. And right away, it was clear that it was a winner, because Kiribati was, you know, not supplied. The Line Islands were not supplied. There was no ship going there from Hawaii. There was only the plane. And they were not very well supplied by Tarawa, their capital, which is almost twice as far as Hawaii is from Christmas Island. So.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't realize it was that far.
Yeah, well, it's not quite. It's 1,800 miles. But that trip is straight upwind and then straight downwind, which is, even for a motor ship, you know, you don't want to go straight upwind.
Huh. Yeah. So you...
And then, you know, we also went down to the Cook Islands and discussed with them, because they had also a shortage of shipping. And, you know, our idea was to serve both countries. Because, you never know when something's going to go wrong. And it's worked well. We've balanced it. You know, we can go wherever there's the most work and the most need, we can go. And we spent quite a lot of time in the Cook Islands when they were short of ships. Now they're not. And we'll, you know, we've tapered off. And we'll still serve the northern group, because they're close enough that we can get there and get back in a short time. But whether we go back to Rarotonga again, that's going to depend on, you know, the shipping down there.
So how many years have you been doing this with the Kwai?
Well, we started in 2006, so we're in our 10th year.
Yeah. And... what does the future hold? I mean, how long do you think?
We don't know. It's, you know, the business wise, we're very subject to changes in the exchange rates between the U.S. dollar and the Australian dollar and the New Zealand dollar. In 2008, which the only year we lost money, it was because of those rates. You know, the U.S. dollar strengthened and the other currencies devalued, so, you know, by a lot, like 30 or 40%. And it's actually happening again now, but it's not so extreme. But it is a big challenge for us. a cheap dollar is much better for us because we buy our cargo in the U.S. So that makes, if we pay in dollar, U.S. dollars and sell in New Zealand and Australia, a weak U.S. dollar gives us a much bigger advantage.
So where does the Australian dollar come in? Where are people?
Oh, that's Kiribati. Kiribati uses Australian dollar, and New Zealand uses, and Cook Islands uses New Zealand dollar.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Huh. So it's a sort of touch-and-go operation still, even after 10 years, it sounds like.
No, it's not really touch-and-go because we have so much... We have so much goodwill. Is mostly why, we could do great with the people. The people have never been an issue, and we do pretty well with the government. You know, with the licensing authorities, and we've managed to stay out of the politics of both areas pretty well. And that's based really on the need of the ship, because the ship does such an important job in both countries. Even more in Kiribati than in the Cooks. So we can survive a pretty bad exchange rate. At a certain point, you know, our goods will get too expensive, and, you know, that will be, maybe that will, you know, we'll have to find some other way to do it. But and for now, we're okay. Even with the high U.S. dollar as it is today, we're still all right. And we also now, what's changed since we started, is that we get work inside the Line Islands, which is not subject to any exchange rate problems, because that's all in AU dollars. When we convert it back to U.S., we don't get as much, but still within... You know, that work within the country is
what kind of work is that?
Well, that's the passengers and local cargoes. And that is a different license than the license we have to bring cargo from outside. And it's regulated by the Foreign Investment Commission. And that license, the government gave to us. They said, here, apply for this and we're going to give it to you. Because they wanted a ship that could serve islands between Christmas, Fanning, and Washington, because they're so short of ships that are able to operate, you know, such a long way from civilization and you know, survive. And the Cooks was a similar situation, but they never gave us finally give us an annual license to carry cargo and passengers between the islands. Only after they lost everything except one ship, so they really needed a ship. But they also gave it to us every time we were there. If there was cargo, we always got it because they would, but we had to get a particular dispensation, they call it. And that's the situation now, because there's plenty of ships there, and it's political. It's, you know, the whole shipping industry is hugely political in the Cook Islands, because it's an island, it's a nation of islands, and you know, it's the lifeblood. And today, there's, you know, three boats operating there, which is plenty. You don't need more than three boats in that country. And
so you're thinking you're going to stop working in the
Cook? No, we'll still go to the Northern Group, because they're, our business is really different, because in the Cooks, we also are licensed to sell directly off the ship, and that's a license that took a little bit to get, but really it was, again, it was the people who asked for it. The all of those islands, Kiribati also, it's the same way. There's nothing they would like more than to be able to buy something right there, put their hands on it, pay the money, and walk away with it, because it's such the opposite of the usual situation where you put in your order, you send your money, and you hope that somebody brings it to you. And, you know, a lot of times it doesn't come. You might have paid for your stuff and you don't get it. And then you have to make a claim. And then, you know, it's just endless. And they really prefer the traditional system, which has, you know, been around for hundreds of years, which was the ship would come as a store. And the people would come out to the boat, or the stuff would come in, and they would look at it and buy it and pay. And that's what we do in the Cooks. In Kiribati, we don't have a license to sell off the ship, so everything has to be ordered. But that is what we do uniquely, is we'll take orders and then bring them the next time. And so will buy for people, like we, you know, because we have access to Costco and Home Depot and Best Buy, and you know, all the good stuff is available right here. So we take the orders, we charge 20% purchasing fee, and then we measure it, we add on the freight, and then we, you know, deliver it to them. And in the Cooks, we sell it directly off the boat. They just pay one, they get one invoice, and that's it. Because we import it, we do the import paperwork. In Kiribati, that's not allowed, so everything is, presented with the customs papers, and the individual customer makes the entry, and then they pay the customs duty, the VAT, and they pay us, and they get the cargo.
Yeah, I mean, the sense I get from everybody who I talk to is they're totally devoted to you and to the Kauai.
Oh, yeah.
The passengers, the crew, the people on land.
Yeah.
It's like they have a greater allegiance to the Kauai and to Brad than they do to the nation of Kiribati, I'll tell you that.
Well, I guess we treat them better. Well, you know, Kiribati is, they you know, they do the best they can. But we understand the nature of commerce, and we have direct connection between the suppliers at a reasonable price and the customers, and our system allows that connection to work. And it's just not available. Like, if you want to buy something from Tarawa, from the capital, it's got to be ordered from Australia, come to Tarawa, be transshipped on another ship, and then, you know, come all the way to Fanning Island. It's too many steps. It doesn't happen. You don't get the possibilities that we can do coming straight from Hawaii.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but do you ever feel like, I mean, you're kind of in it for life, whether you like it or not, in a way. I mean, what would people do if the Kauai stopped?
Well, Kauai can stop anytime. It just takes one time the engine doesn't start, and you're on the reef, and the boat's gone. So they will accept that just like we will have to. It's a fact of life. And, you know, they're islanders. They're used to it, and that's, you know, Kauai's not the first ship that's served them. You know, even though we do a good job, it's... You know.
Yeah. So you don't feel like, like some moral compulsion, like, oh my God.
Oh, of course we do. They're our customers. We're going to do our best to serve them, but, you know, I can't, you know, if it's not possible, it's not possible. Yeah. It has to work for a lot of ways. It has to work here in Honolulu. We have to have it, you know, the stevedores have to support us enough that we can, you know, load the ship without, problems that would make it impossible.
What kind of problems?
We have a working relationship with the stevedores, which is a good relationship. But if we were treated like Matson is treated, you know, that you had to have, a gang of 11 guys, you know, every time anything moved, we couldn't support it. It wouldn't work. There's just not enough money to make that happen. And, you know, our flag state is the Cook Islands. That means that we sail under their jurisdiction, their inspection routine, their certificates. But those are also enforced by the Coast Guard. The Port State Control has the right to come and inspect the ship at any time. All of those factors are hugely, you know, we're hugely dependent on them working, you know, and anytime, you're dealing with the bureaucracy and the international commerce system, you could run against something that, that makes it not possible. The good thing is we've been doing it so long, we're kind of grandfathered in, and, you know, because we are different. We really do work differently than, you know, any other ships out on the ocean. And,
yeah, so it seems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is different. It's a throwback, really, in a lot of ways, to the old system. And in that old system, there was a lot less bureaucracy than there is now. So, you know, everything, you know, you've got the IMO, which is in charge of shipping all around the world. And they can make all kinds of rules that are applicable to big ships. If they get applied to a ship our size and the business we're doing, again, it could be, you know, it could be a brick wall that you can't get through. But we hope that doesn't happen. We trust that it won't happen, and, you know, we keep going.
Yeah, I wasn't really thinking we'd talk all about business, but actually it's really interesting. And Evie was telling me about the sustainable shipping conference that you guys went to in Fiji.
Yeah, he went. Yeah.
Oh, he went. Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought that you went as well.
No.
Oh, but he was saying that you had been, that people were asking you to kind of replicate the Kauai or in other parts of the Pacific or something like this. I wasn't completely.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. There's, you know, it's a good model, you know, and there's lots of islands that could work, and you know, I think that once we got started and had the ship going, we could have worked in other areas. I think there's plenty of room for other ships to work.
But do you have actual offers of people inviting you to come to this island?
Oh, sure, all the time. Not from governments or anything, but just from people. They want service. They, you know, they see, oh, wow. Well, here in Hawaii, you got lots of islanders living here from the Marshall Islands, you know, from all over the Pacific. And they always, you know, they traditionally come to us and said, hey, can you go to, you know, here for us? And I said, I'm sorry, we're tied up. We got our route. This is what we're doing. We can't just go on.
I can't even hear you. Hold on. Sorry.
Planes here, pretty endless.
Yeah, they're right by the airport. Yeah, but do you imagine doing that? Do you imagine like expanding and adding another boat?
No, I'm too old to expand. I'm not getting another ship. But the opportunity is there.
So what makes the difference? I mean, obviously you're different. You're different.
You know, we do it for the love of sailing and the islands and the people. You have to make a living, and you can't dismiss that in any way, because that is, if you don't make money, you're not going to survive. And we don't want to be subsidized. We don't want to be non-profit. We want it to be for-profit business. And we have shareholders, and we want to pay them a dividend. That's what our intentions are, and, you know, occasionally we do that. And we wouldn't want it any differently. But it's not, none of us are in this to get rich. We would find other ways if that was what was our goal. And I'm not referring only to the investors, I'm referring to all the crew, everybody who works with us. We're not driven by money. It's not, you know, that's not the goal. The lifestyle is the goal. The lifestyle and all the wonderful things that happen when you're doing it.
Is there a certain moment that you can, I'm sure there's a million of them, but is there any moment when you were out on the Kauai when you just realized like it all clicked and it all came together?
Oh, it happens all the time.
Yeah.
And it's like this magic moment when everything works together, you know, like you're just there and you just happen, you know, oh, and this deal just comes up and yeah, that happens. And what also happens a lot is the ship just doing her work and you just stand up on the bridge and you go, wow, this is so amazing. And all your full moon night, you got 60 passengers on the deck and they're all singing and, you know, it's a nice calm night, everybody's happy, and it's wonderful. There's nothing like it.
Yeah. And then tell me about your crew. I mean, it seems like most of your crew is Kiribati now.
That's
huh?
right.
And was that sort of a choice that you've made?
Well, they're the most suited to the job and the most loyal. You know, we don't want people coming for, you know, one or two trips. That's fine, and that can work. But for the real basic job, which is handling the cargo and doing the deck work, and, you know, we want people who are here all the time. And for them, it's a really good job, not just because the pay is reasonable compared to what they make at home, but because they get to come to Honolulu. And like all Polynesian communities, if you can provide for your family or your group, you know, that builds up yourself. And they're able to do that here. They, you know, even if it's just going to Walmart and buying the toys that go back to the kids, that's huge. There's nothing, you know, nobody else is doing it. So they get to do that. And they also, you know, it's family here. This is, you know, for them, it's, Kiribati is very important to be part of a group. And Kauai is a good group to be part of. It's got a lot going for it. And, as a result, they're very loyal, and it works. It works for us. We're trying, you know, to expand it, really, to get, you know, because we're, for the licensed positions, we don't have anyone from Kiribati. Though we did have one mate from Kiribati, but he lives in the Cook Islands. And but we'd really like to expand the Kiribati participation in the business and the ship if we can.
So what does it take to get the Kiribati crew license so that
they got to go to school?
Where do they do that?
Well, probably in New Zealand or Australia. It's going to be that would be the normal channel for them.
And then how is it for the crew when they get to Honolulu? How are they treated here? Or how is it for them?
Well, there's a big Kiribati community here, so they're pretty much, that's their connection to Hawaii society, I would say. So it's strong, it's fine. They've got places to go and people to take them shopping, and they're well taken care of.
Yeah.
And they know their way around by now, too.
Right. So it seems. So I feel like we need to wrap up, but I wonder if... I'm trying to think what to narrow it down to. I mean, I feel like this ship has such a personality. I mean, do you ever think of the ship as like a person?
Always. The ship has her own personality.
And so how would you describe her as a person?
Oh, she's just a workhorse. You know, you just watch her plowing through the ocean. She's, you know, remember I told her she was almost went for scrap. She's so happy to be out in the world and about in a new place and, you know, being loved and serviced that she's just wants to go. The only thing she doesn't like is to sit around too long in port. Time she gets unhappy.
How does she express her unhappiness?
Well, I don't know. I can't really tell you that. I can tell you the happiness, though. If you go stand on the bow and you watch her cutting through the water, there's no doubt in your mind. It's just, you just know it.
Yeah. I can't imagine you cutting yourself loose ever. I mean, what do you think you would do if you didn't do this?
Well, I'm going to retire. We're looking for people to take over, and, you know, I'm going to retire. You can't go to sea forever when you get old.
What are you going to do when you retire?
Well, I'm going to, you know, live on my farm, home with my wife, and go surfing every day, and the things I do now when I'm off the ship. It's in place already.
Yeah, and you won't miss it?
Oh, of course. You know, but I will, you know, well, I hope to stay involved, even if I'm not going to sea. I don't know. We don't know what the future will hold, but
Yeah.
I've got enough memories too. I can retire pretty easily.
That's good. So is there anything else? I feel like we could have talked for hours. There's so many things I had, you know, that crossed my mind while we were traveling, but I'm glad we got to talk at all. This is great. And I just wonder if there's anything else that you had in mind that you wanted to make sure.
No, I think you've done a really good job. I think you got everything in place.
Okay. Well, thank you. Yeah. I really appreciate it.